The Department of Health and Human Services is sitting on over 12,000 claims by Americans injured by the COVID shots. They have a denial rate of 98%. The average payout is about $3,700.
Dr. Joel Walskog is an orthopedic surgeon who found himself permanently disabled after getting the COVID-19 genetic vaccine.
If you look, my report is still in VAERS. I'm listed as not serious.
In this episode, he shares his personal story and what we know about those injured by the COVID vaccines.
The neurological adverse events are very common and unfortunately not recognized.
And we dive into what the NIH actually knows about treating them, which was revealed in a suppressed preprint report.
The FDA, the CDC, and NIH, I really think they think the American public is dumb.
This is American Thought Leaders, and I'm Yanya Kelik. Dr. Joel Walskog, such a pleasure to have you on American Thought Leaders.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with, of course, COVID-19 vaccine injury. You, of course, work with numerous COVID vaccine injured people. You yourself are injured. I want to get a picture now as we speak of the range of injuries that you experience or you have found in some of the 36,000 people that are part of REACT-19.
Every COVID vaccine injured person is unique. There's not just one syndrome. It's really a constellation of different syndromes. And even according to our recent study, we did a survey of preliminary results of 850 people. The average number of symptoms these injured people are reporting is 43 in each person. So what we found is a lot of their syndromes can be kind of fall into three buckets. There's the anaphylaxis group. That's the people that get the shot, have an immediate severe allergic reaction. But that also includes the mast cell disorder group. And then there's an autoimmune group. Okay. And then last, there's the inflammatory group. And that includes things like blood clotting disorders and the myocarditis. So there's really just a plethora of different syndromes out there. And unfortunately, there's really no ongoing research into these injuries, and therefore, we don't have great diagnoses. They're very vague. We don't have great diagnostics or testing, and we don't really have specific treatments. There are some people, and FLCCC, for example, is developing treatment protocols, but a lot of them are what I would call as empiric. Empiric means they're just trying things that make sense pathophysiologically or from a mechanism of action, but they're kind of just empiric treatment, and we really need better defined diagnoses, more specific diagnostic testing, and more specific treatments.
So let's talk about this preprint from 2022, published by NIH scientists. 23 people were flown out to NIH, assessed for a COVID vaccine injury, and actually in many cases treated successfully. So there is some research being done.
Scant research, but I think that's an important study the public needs to know. So in 2021, this is early on, in 2021, several people were reporting that they had neurological adverse events. 23 people, 23 Americans, and Brianne Dressen, who is my co-chair at REACT-19, was one of those 23. 23 Americans, mostly women, were flown out to the NIH on the NIH's dime, housed there, studied. They admitted they all had neurological adverse events to the shots. Treatment protocols were made, okay, and they actually then had a preprint article about the group, which came out later in 2022, about a year later. And what that preprint said is, first of all, time is of the essence. The quicker you get to people, the more likely treatments will be successful. And they also talked about treatments that are available, steroids, if steroids don't work, IVIG, which is IV immune globulin. But the problem is that information never got out to the healthcare system in general. And we have been actually, through REACT, the ones communicating these treatment protocols that were made by the NIH in 2021, never recognized, okay, by the FDA or CDC, and just left. So we are the ones that often talk to people, you know, have you tried this? Have you tried this? And a lot of times, have you tried IVIG? So, and for certain people, the IVIG can be life-changing.
So we know that whatever protocols they used, for some reason not detailed in this paper exactly, but we know that these things actually worked in at least some of these cases, like Brian Dressen's case. They know how it works. They know that they can treat it.
A lot of the people got better. Right. I'm not saying, if you look at the preprint, it sounds like they're cured. And we know a lot of those. I think we know about 12 of the 23, I'm estimating. And they're not all cured. I mean, Brian Dressen still every other week gets IVIG. But without that knowledge that those select group received through the NIH, you know, they wouldn't have gotten any improvement. But think about how many, perhaps thousands of people could benefit if that type of information was communicated from the NIH, was recognized by the FDA, was recognized by the CDC. Brianne and I have been on the phone on a Zoom call with Peter Marks, who is a head of biologics at the FDA, and talked to him about this. Why don't you communicate this, Dr. Marks, this preprint information of this case series that was done by Dr. Arvind Nath, who is a very respected physician researcher at the NIH. But when we talk to Dr. Marks, that just falls on deaf ears.
So we know that there are people in these government agencies that know that COVID vaccine injury is actually a thing. They know how to treat at least some of the manifestations of it. We've had examples of that. There's even this preprint that we've just been discussing. But there is no communication about this broadly. I mean, and one of the things that comes out in talking to COVID vaccine injured, as I have been on this show and just personally, is that most doctors just simply don't know to look for this as a possible cause of this constellation of symptoms that we've been discussing. Like, how do you square that?
Well, this is complicated, and again, I would start by saying that I saw some of the emails back and forth between Arvind Nath and Brianne and some other people, and I really think he wanted to help. And early on, they were we have to work on this, we want to get this out, we want to help people. And then there was kind of a sudden stop and a ghosting, which tells me that I think his intentions were good, but I think he had to get direction from elsewhere that kind of said, stop this. And remember, that's no different than, you know, some of the censorship direction that came directly from the White House, which said to social media companies, for example, stop, you know, censor any narrative out there, even true vaccine injuries, okay, that might compromise the narrative that the COVID shots are the only way out of the pandemic. So I think there's a lot of directed censorship, and sometimes I don't know where it comes from.
So let's talk about your personal journey. You were, of course, COVID vaccine injured. You were a medical doctor in a very, very different field compared to what you're working on now. And you suffered a pretty serious vaccine injury.
So first of all, I want to say that, you know, I don't want anyone's sympathy, you know, and truly, I've been very blessed throughout my whole life. And I don't do what I do now for myself. You know, I feel blessed to help these people. And I frankly, by forming RAC-19 and being an advocate for all these injured people, I certainly receive more than I ever give. But you know, I was an orthopedic surgeon, board certified, licensed in the state of Texas and Wisconsin, and really had a great career. I was in practice for about 20 years. I had a very, what I would call as a mature practice, meaning I just had to show up, and you know, I had a very large patient base, and I operated, you know, 2 days a week for about 12, 14 hours per day, and had a big team of people, several, you know, PAs, nurse practitioners, and nurses, and did clinic 3 days a week, and just was on what I would say is the hamster wheel of life. loved it, you know, married to my college sweetheart, you know, had four mostly wonderful children. I'm just kidding, but four great kids. And really was, you know, what I would say is just living a dream life. I mean, I would say that, I mean, everything I wanted to achieve, I did. And it was great. But it all kind of came to a screeching halt, you know, in early 2021. I was the product of the healthcare system that I was a part of for decades. At the same point, you know, the healthcare workers were what we call the 1A group, where we were getting the shots first. And literally, I remember the end of December, I got a email and said, you know, your number's up, come and get your shot. And literally, I drove down to a hospital, got my shot over lunchtime, went back, went to work. And it was unremarkable. But about 7 days later, I remember waking up from bed and I said to my wife, I said, you know, my feet are numb. And I mean, like pins and needles. And it was pretty dramatic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've had some neck problems in the past. I thought maybe I had a herniated disc that was touching on my spinal cord. And, you know, no thought about the shot whatsoever being related at that point. So I called a friend of mine and they got an MRI of my neck because I figured maybe that's it. You know, got that, nothing new. And then move forward, I think, I can't remember exactly, but say 5 to 7 days later, I was sitting with a patient, just sitting across, just like talking to you in the clinic. And I tried to stand up and my legs wouldn't move. And so then I remember, you know, using my hands, pushing off the examining table that we weren't using, but just pushing off the examination table, and I fell backwards. I just had no control of my legs. It was at that point where I knew something serious and more ominous was going on. I mean, I clearly thought I had a brain tumor or spinal cord something, or something more serious. So literally, I remember I being part of the healthcare system, I literally picked up the phone and called an MRI center where I worked and said, I'm coming, and got MRIs of my, in the end, brain and spinal cord. And I ended up having a demyelinated lesion of my spinal cord at about the T8 or T9 or that thoracic T8 or T9 level. And that's where I got a diagnosis of transverse myelitis. So I quickly saw a neurologist within 2 days, and you know, I started going on high dose steroids and tried all this other things. They ordered a bunch of other tests to rule out everything else because I wanted to make sure I didn't have anything else. So looking for multiple sclerosis and all these other things, and everything else was negative except this lesion on my spinal cord. Again, still, I had never put two and two together about the shot, even though my symptoms started. I say I got kind of hit like a Mack truck within about 7 days. I still didn't put the things together. Until I remember having the thought of remembering reading about the AstraZeneca trials of the COVID-19 shots in the UK. And I did read that those trials in the UK were delayed twice for just 3 cases of transverse myelitis. And that's when I started putting things together. And I was like, well, and I talked to my neurologist. He basically said, possibly, you know, you don't know. But again, he also told me, and I want to quote him because this is a quote, Joel, I don't want to get involved, end quote. And that's kind of the attitude that a lot of the injured people get, is that the providers do not want to be involved because they don't want to get attacked by saying anything is potentially related to the vaccine. I reported, as soon as I got that diagnosis of transverse myelitis, I reported my injury to VAERS, which is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And because of the UK trial, the AstraZeneca trial that got delayed twice for just 3 cases of transverse myelitis, I thought this was big. And really, I reported it, you know, through VAERS, and I literally, in my naive world, thought someone from the CDC would be contacting me like that day. Days passed, weeks passed, nothing. And I was like, I was really thinking about the general public. I was like, holy crap. You know, all these, you know, the UK thing was so serious that they stopped the trial twice for these three cases. Why aren't they calling me? So then finally, after about 3 to 4 weeks, I called the CDC. I talked to someone, a physician from the CDC, and they said they'd get back to me. I had to fill out another report or two. And she said, again, transverse myelitis was a diagnosis of interest to them. And then nothing happened. And really, to this day, I've had no further interaction from them, no follow-up. If you look, my report is still in VAERS. I'm listed as not serious, okay? And I asked her about that, and she said by federal law, to be called serious in VAERS, you either have to die or be hospitalized. Well, my neurologist did recommend I get hospitalized, but I don't really like being in hospitals, especially as a patient. And I said, listen, I mean, at that point, I mean, I'm potentially lifelong disabled. How can this be not serious? And she said, well, that's the law. And I said, well, that's crazy. And so to this day, I mean, again, that's how I'm listed in VAERS, as transverse myelitis with, you know, being non-serious. Even though at this point, I'm permanently disabled. I've lost my career, which is okay. I mean, it certainly took a while for me to be okay with it. But it's a crazy system.
So you're making me think, frankly, a little bit of my own personal story of ending up here in this chair. You know, at one point, I was in a career in biology, and I ended up with Guillain-Barré syndrome, which destroyed my career and put me on this path that led me to the Epoch Times ultimately. And so, you know, which I'm in a way incredibly grateful for, and I can't help but think that, you know, your own journey to be doing this, having someone like you advocating for COVID vaccine injured people is, I'd call it a huge blessing to them. So it's just, it's interesting how life works, right?
Well, it's a blessing to me. I mean, really, I truly believe. I mean, again, my entire life was everything I wanted, everything I tried to achieve, I did. I mean, now this is something that was completely out of my control. But again, 2021 was a struggle of what am I going to do next? One of the transformational events for me through this whole process was in November of 2021, I was invited to speak with several injured people, including Brian Dressen, who is now my co-chair at React 19. And, you know, so 2021 was a year where I felt, you know, like people look at you like, early on too, they look at you like you're crazy. I mean, if you said I had an adverse event to the shot, well, you're nuts, or you have an anxiety problem, which I don't. But I mean, you really feel like the one word that describes for me 2021 was abandoned. You're kind of out on an island, and you think that you're alone, and there's no one else like you, and you literally are kind of shunned. I mean, you can tell when people look at you. You can tell when you try to talk to providers, when they roll their eyes, or, you know, all the little ways that we get gaslit. But for me, when I went out to D.C. and we had that press conference with Senator Johnson, for me it was transformational. You know, seeing that I wasn't alone, seeing how much these other people were struggling, and, you know, again, I'm very fortunate in life. I've been blessed my whole life. So, I left there, and I remember getting in the Uber, going back to the airport, and I called my wife, and I said, you know, I know what I have to do. And that's really the start of really React 19. I mean, I have to say Brian Dressen is really the founder of React 19. And React 19 existed even before, you know, November of 2021, and she ran it as kind of a support group and a website. But we really wanted, we agreed, and all of the people that were out in D.C. agreed that they wanted to make it a real organization. So we formed a Wisconsin-based corporation. It's like a startup company. You know, we made bylaws, we elected officers, and we applied for our 501c3 status, which we got. And we started with those 10 people, and now we represent over 36,000 Americans injured by the shots. We have 18 international partners. I'm sure we're the largest advocacy organization in the world. Not because we tried. I mean, it's not like we advertised. They just kept coming, and they still keep coming.
So one of the statistics we put in the Unseen Crisis film, which of course we made about the COVID vaccine injured and their stories that Brianne Dressen stars in, is we made a comparison of how much money was given out from the existing compensation programs and from REACT-19, which indeed has made a point of helping COVID vaccine injured basically, recover, or helping them fund their recovery. I'm wondering if you could actually update those numbers for me.
Yeah, so these people are financially, physically, and emotionally abandoned. Okay, but when we start just talking about how financially, I mean, a lot of these people can't work, they're disabled, go through, Social Security disability, people get rejected, it takes a year or two to get a, response. So these people are really, many of them are truly financially devastated. So because of the PREP Act, okay, we can't sue. So the PREP Act, so the government or the HHS secretary back in 2020 declared a public health emergency. And when there's a public health emergency, the PREP Act is activated, let me say it that way. The PREP Act gives blanket immunity to pharma, to the government, to our healthcare organizations, to healthcare providers. So they're completely immune, so we can't sue them. And all of the normal FDA regulatory rules and processes are thrown out the window, right? Because a normal vaccine takes oftentimes 5 to 10 years to get approved. So the public health emergency, all the FDA regulations and norms go out the window. There is a compensation program that's existed for decades called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. It is a real program with real money. I think it has like $4 billion in it right now, and it's pharma funded. So every time a vaccine dose is made or sold, pharma has to pay an excise tax, say 75 cents, to this fund. Okay? And if your child gets injured, let's say for a vaccine that's on a childhood schedule, you can basically apply to go to the VICP program, which is kind of like a court. It has judges and you know the rules, right? It's a real program. Remember, the COVID shots weren't vaccines. They were considered countermeasures because of public health emergency. So we have to apply to the Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program, or the CICP. That program is a dismal failure. So right now, the Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, is sitting on over 12,000 claims by Americans injured by the COVID shots. They have a denial rate of 98%. And these numbers are from January 1st, reported on the CDC's website, January 1st of 2024. They have a 98% denial rate. The average payout is about $3,700. Remember, these are some people that have been decimated by the vaccine and get $3,700. Now, REACT-19, we raise, the number one thing we raise for is our CARE Fund. Our CARE Fund is a program that pays injured Americans financial grants for up to $10,000 for uncovered medical expenses. I'm very proud of what we've done. We've paid out well over $750,000 through very grassroots fundraising. The average donation we receive is about $80. Okay? We have zero corporate funding. Believe me, I've tried. I've reached out to some people, big name celebrity people you'd think might be successful, you think might be helpful, without success. So these are just grassroots fundraising that's helped us raise that money. Now, so the grants that we've given out are over $750,000. I think we've given out to about 107 people. Now, that's a drop in the bucket. So it's heartbreaking. When we give out the money, I mean, these people absolutely need it. Some are living in their cars. I see their financial. I look at every application. I see their bank accounts. You know, it's heartbreaking. It's like saving zero, retirement zero, checking $300. It's heartbreaking.
So you say you give a maximum of $10,000 per person.
So what we do, to be fair, is they have to wait at least a year in between, you know, reapplying for the grant program. But again, I admit, I mean, you know, this is a drop in the bucket. The problem out there needs millions, maybe even billions of dollars to help these people. Right? And I truly believe it should be pharma funded. That's why our organization supports, we demand actually legislation where the CICP claims are transferred to the VICP with what we call retroactivity, which means that for those injured already in the last 3 years, they can still either apply to the VICP, or if they applied to the CICP and got denied, they can then apply to the VICP.
So for the benefit of anyone who wants to reach out to REACT 19 in the first place, or you know, possibly believes they could benefit from the CARE Fund, or maybe even donate to the CARE Fund or contribute to it in some other way, how do they reach you?
The best way to reach us is through our website. So it's www.react19.org. That's by far the best way. And if anyone wants to donate, you can also donate through our website. I mean, we are really desperate for donations. I mean, it's rough, and these people need help. And I promise to all of your viewers that, I mean, what we do is we are 100% volunteer organization. Brianne and I take, none of us take a dollar, a cent from the organization. So the other way people can get donate if they wish is they can text the word REACT, R-E-A-C-T, to the number 50155. But there are ways through our website too if people are just looking to try to apply for the CARE Fund. There are avenues through there to apply. And if anyone has any specific questions about the CARE Fund, they should email carefund@react19.org.
So I remember a presentation that you did about a year ago that where you talked about how something like 80% of the injuries that you had seen at that time were neurological. Typically, in the, let's say, in the broader narrative or the legacy media, you're hearing more about myocarditis signal, right? Or that's what you hear about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my feeling is, yeah, overall with the COVID shot injuries, about 80% of people's adverse events include some component of our neurological component. So, and again, there's been a lot of focus on myocarditis, but in our most recent survey of the people that were injured that reported to our that responded to our survey, only about 5% were diagnosed with myocarditis. So for us, you know, we're trying to get out there the communication that that the neurological adverse events are very common and unfortunately not recognized well. Now, that's not to say that the myocarditis isn't significant. And a lot of the people that have myocarditis are, you know, young, healthy, often young, healthy males who really didn't need a shot anyway. So it's certainly a tragedy. And most recently, what Epoch Times had reported was there were communications in governmental agencies that in 2021 that they should alert the public that there is a safety signal for myocarditis. And unfortunately, they, in their communications, opted not to send out the communication. And that was 2021. You know, that's almost 3 years ago. And that's a tragedy. I mean, they openly decided to censor that information. It's a trail of censorship to try to censor anything that's against the narrative that the COVID shots were the only way out of this pandemic. And it robs the American public of informed consent. And informed consent is very important. You know, as a physician, I mean, we have to tell patients risks, benefits, and options, okay? You know, what's the risk of COVID to a 16-year-old male? Not much. Infection fatality rate, or IFR, is zero. What are the benefits? Okay, but what are the options? Have they had COVID? Natural immunity. None of those conversations really ever occurred. But to give the American public informed consent, you have to trust them. You have to give them information. But I truly believe the FDA, the CDC, and NIH, I really think they think the American public is dumb, and which is not true. I mean, if you give people information, they can make their own choices. And again, we're in America where you should have individual liberty and be able to make those choices. But by robbing us of that information, of robbing us of that safety signal information in 2021, it's wrong. It's unethical. It's immoral.
Yeah, and I mean, informed consent, in my view, is really kind of a foundational principle of medicine.
Absolutely. And it's, a lot of people think it's, oh, you sign a form. Okay. Informed consent is not the form. The form is just recognition that a conversation occurred about the risks, benefits, and alternatives of the proposed intervention. Okay. And now you have the FDA who is recognizing that there's growing hesitancy, not just to the COVID-19 shots, but growing hesitancy to the broader vaccine schedule. Surprise, surprise. The American public is starting to get it. Okay, safe and effective, prevents infection, prevents transmission. People are starting to kind of figure it out. Even Anthony Fauci recently said that that 6-foot rule just kind of came out of thin air. Okay, so a lot of things happened that they said were all science-based, but people are starting to get, okay, everything we're told wasn't necessarily true, and people are waking up. How do we know that? Look at the uptake of the current boosters. According to the FDA, it's dismal. Okay, and Peter Marks just wrote a viewpoint in online Journal of American Medical Association, and he said his vaccine hesitancy kind of, and I'm paraphrasing, at a turning point, meaning is the American public now with growing hesitancy towards the COVID shots, is this going to transfer over to hesitancy from to overall the overall vaccine schedule? Absolutely, right? Because people are losing, the American public is losing trust, okay, in our federal regulatory agencies. The FDA's mission, their sole mission, is to protect the American public from drugs and medical devices. It is not to promote vaccines, yet you can see those little cartoon ads that Peter Marks does that they spend hundreds of millions of dollars. That's not their job, okay? They're not there to promote these countermeasures. Again, not really, COVID shots were a countermeasure. They're there to protect us. And they're the ones that are supposed to be looking at the data, showing us the data, and gaining our trust. In his viewpoint, all he says is that the healthcare community and pharmacists need to be better at messaging. Messaging. The problem isn't messaging. The problem is trust of the American public, which they're losing. And he fails to understand how himself, his office, and the FDA themselves are part of that growing mistrust. Because we were told a lot of things that just weren't true.
So what is your advice from your standpoint to the CDC, to the FDA, to the NIH about what to do now, given everything that we've seen?
Number one, eliminate conflicts of interest, okay? Again, everybody knows that anybody good at the CDC or FDA that's very pro-pharma ends up getting a board of director or a big job at pharma when they leave, okay? Next, stop direct marketing, pharma marketing, to consumers. We did it with cigarettes, okay? We stopped it. But the problem is they shouldn't, in my opinion, pharma shouldn't directly advertise to consumers because they're They're driving their products, and the average American consumer doesn't know enough. But that patient then goes to the doctor and says, I want this. Stop that direct to consumer marketing.
And if I might jump in before you do your third point, there's also this effect. I mean, these are huge amounts of money that we, you know, we've looked seen being channeled into media companies from Big Pharma to do this marketing. And I mean, it, I think it also potentially creates another conflict of interest where, you know, are you really going to report on, you know, some of these serious issues we've been talking today if you're getting 50% of your $1 billion, you know, revenue from companies that wouldn't like you
reporting? Absolutely. Remember, pharma money goes to media companies, and if they obviously are supportive of the pharma companies, they're more likely to get more ads. But that pharma money goes to our scientific journals. If people think today that our scientific journals aren't corrupted by pharma money, I mean, pharma money feeds right into those scientific journals, feeds right into researchers, right? If you're going to do research and continually do research that shows bad results with a company's product, and they're the funder of the study, well, you're not going to get business. And don't forget, too, pharma money has infiltrated our political system. So that pharma money is everywhere. And I do think that's a big problem. But getting back to what else I would tell, what else I would recommend, one of the big things the regulatory agencies need to do is go back to science. True and transparent science. Show data. Show the data, okay? Remember, people don't understand who owns the data on the COVID shots from the clinical trials. People think, oh, it's the government. No, it's not, pharma. Okay? Pharma owns it. That's why they didn't want to release it for 75 years. So get the data out there, show things, good and bad. And again, in science, you make a hypothesis, you test it, okay? It may work out for you. You may get results that you expect. You may get results that you don't expect. But that's science. And even after you make a conclusion, you may end up getting new data that's contrary and may change your ultimate conclusion. That's science. It's okay to be wrong, okay? But to not admit you're wrong when you're wrong, I think is evil. And I think that's really where they failed. I mean, again, you remember when Fauci said, oh, I am science. I mean, what? It's an insult to the American public, okay? Science isn't absolute, okay? And people do make mistakes, but they need to be truthful. Get true and transparent data, and they need to regain the trust of the American people.
You know, it strikes me that this transparency, for me, I think one of the most valuable things would be a kind of radical transparency around data. And because that would show goodwill, like if we couldn't figure it out ourselves or we weren't willing to, at least we can give it to, you know, allow. And there's, frankly, an incredible sort of flourishing of people from, you know, who have, you know, expertise and, you know, numbers from other areas who have started tackling what scant data is available, making fascinating discoveries out of that data, right? Like actually proving themselves to be much, apparently much more curious than the people that are supposed to be doing the work in the first place. My point is there's actually an ecosystem ready, I feel, to handle this this data and deal with it, you know, ethically and also, you know, rigorously. Right. So it would be very valuable. And I think we would learn some things very quickly.
Absolutely. Science should be reproducible. So if you're able to say, OK, I've figured out this solution, true science is reproducible. You should have someone else look at that same information and say, yes, I verify it works. And part of science is reproducibility. But they have hidden so much of this data. And again, as you know, most of this data has come out just through Freedom of Information Act releases, court dealings, where basically organizations or law firms are suing to get data released, which is a tragedy. Which, if you're continually hiding things, what does that say? You know, and that's why I get very suspicious that there's always more going on.
So, you know, so one of I want to cover very briefly what legislation you're involved in, and also what, you know, the status of some of these lawsuits that React 19 is involved in?
So we've been fairly active in Washington, D.C., particularly at the federal level, really working towards compensation reform. As we've talked about, the current compensation program for the COVID shot injuries is the CICP, which is really a dismal, dismal failure. So in the last 2 years, we have been out to D.C. numerous times, meeting with politicians, independents, Republicans, Democrats. Our call is completely non-political, or nonpartisan, let me put it that way. They all agree that the CICP has failed. The problem is there's been little action in D.C. However, I do want to say that there are two House bills that are floating around called House Bill 5142 and 43, which have to do with modernizing the VICP and transferring the CICP claims with retroactivity over to the VICP, and we support that legislation. Now, it's far from getting just as a proposed bill to something that also, there's no companion bill yet or something similar in the Senate, and it's certainly not on the president's desk for signature. And it really is kind of stalled, which is frustrating. So one thing we're doing, which is we are going to have the first ever COVID vaccine shot lobbyist in D.C. for about 4 months. So we raised some money, and it's Kyle Warner, who is a ex-professional, professional mountain bike rider, who is a great guy. I call him cool, calm, and collected. He's perfect to represent us. And he's going to go out to D.C. and lobby for us full-time for 4 months. And I've just seen that, you know, you can have a lot of phone calls with some of the politicians and their health aides, but face-to-face time is very important. So we're doing that. And if we can get more funding, which would be a blessing, I'd love to have a full-time person out there all year. Because it's important, because we need to get this legislation going. We need to get these people compensation. And again, not $3,700 for getting myocarditis, real compensation, okay? Like that people do receive in the VICP. And again, I don't want the taxpayers on the dole or on the have to pay the bill like they do in the CICP. I want pharma to fund it. And that's what happens in the VICP, which is pharma funds that program. And believe it or not, the biopharma lobbyist group supports 5142 and 43, which actually surprises me. It's also supported by the Vaccine Injury Trial Association that I recall. So it's good legislation that's ready to go, it's just not going anywhere. So as we get frustrated, okay, so for me, I see this as an urgent need. These people need money, okay, that are injured to put food on the table, to put clothes in their kids' backs, you know, to pay their mortgage now, okay? And it's been frustrating. And again, when I'm out there in D.C., they don't feel that urgency. So that's why we've gotten involved in some litigation, okay? So React 19 and six individual injured people have filed suit last October, so October of 2023, against HHS, which is Health and Human Services, HRSA, for basically an infringement because the CICP is such a dismal failure, okay, it infringes on our Fifth and Seventh constitutional rights, our Fifth and Seventh Amendment of the Constitution. So Fifth is the right of due process. The Seventh Amendment has to do with the right to a jury trial. Well, we are denied those rights through the CICP. Okay, there's no jury. We submit an application, like I did, for example, I think in May of 2021. It goes into this black hole, as Aaron Siri describes. You don't know who reviews it. You don't know what criteria they'd use. You just wait and wait for a denial. As I said, the program is a 98% denial rate. It took me 18 months to get a denial. Just like 98% of the people, we're all getting denied. So then I appealed, and I submitted one of Arvind Nath's papers that talks about transverse myelitis as being recognized after the COVID shots. I said, how can you deny transverse myelitis isn't related? I was totally healthy until 7 days after the shot. So I appealed. That appeal was 14 months ago. I still don't have a response to my appeal. Now, I know my appeal will be denied. That's the dismal state of that system. So as we wait for legislative reform and compensation, we're really forced to go to the courts. We're forced to go to the courts because, in my opinion, if we can get these cases through summary judgment and into discovery, where we can start learning more about what people, you know, what people knew and when, I think it might wake the American public up. And if the American public wakes up and puts pressure on the politicians, maybe they'll move quicker. That's my hope. But my goal, you know, our goal in suing people isn't the lawsuit. Okay, I don't think we're going to take down PREP Act immunity. I'm pretty realistic. But our real goal is compensation reform and getting it moving. Getting it moving so these people can get some relief.
Well, Joel, any final thoughts as we finish?
Well, I'm excited to tell you a little bit about a clinic, a medical clinic that we're trying to start in Fort Worth, Texas this year. So this is a separate project outside REACT. It's really a collaboration between people with COVID shot injuries as well as long COVID, okay? We support people with long COVID too, and national providers that we trust. It's a brand new idea, which is for all of us to collaborate together to make a new multi-specialty clinic to treat complex chronic illnesses like long COVID and COVID shot injuries. We have a very generous donor, but it's gonna be a nonprofit organization. We're gonna staff this with providers we trust. We're gonna be involved. We're gonna be involved in research because we do believe that the research here into our injuries is incredibly important to get better diagnoses, better diagnostic testing, and better treatment. So we're super excited about that here in 2024.
Yeah, and you know, perhaps you'll be, in effect, you'll be developing part of this, you know, parallel medical system that the FLCCC, you know, is seeking to kind of, you know, spearhead or push forward.
Yeah, Paul Merrick is gonna be the lead of our medical advisory board creating our protocols. So we're all here on the same side, okay? We are about, you know, in FLCCC and REACT 19, we are here to work together to provide better care for these people. So again, REACT 19, you know, we are an advocacy organization, but we're a very proactive advocacy organization. You know, one of the key, I think, elements of our organization is action. You know, we're not just here to tell our sad stories. I mean, sometimes we do, okay? But the truth of the matter is, I don't even like telling my story. It's what I want is action. I want action to help these people. And oftentimes we'll say, we're here to take our negative reactions and turn it into positive actions. That's a path to healing. These people need hope and support, and that's what we're about.
Well, Dr. Joel Walskog, it's such a pleasure to have you on.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you all for joining Dr. Joel Walskog and me on this episode of American Thought Leaders. I'm your host, Yanya Kellick.